Welcome to Red Meat, a tasty assortment of conservative audio from Odyssey's news talk stations across the country. We're covering a lot of ground this week: kids and vulnerability to crime, efforts to legalize prostitution in one of America's favorite cities, because that doesn't sound like a disaster, am I right? We've got fears of nuclear war all the way to, you guessed it, the new Pope and theories about why the Vatican chose an American. We're kicking it off today with Annie Frey in St. Louis.
2,300 people daily are reported missing in this country. And while the majority of those cases are closed within 24 to 72 hours, they're not always closed the way we would want them to be, but at least those loved ones, those people who worry about the missing in their own homes and families, at least they get some answers that they can move forward with.
Yeah.
But when you have unknown, it's an open wound. And for these families not to have their loved ones, some as young as three that we've been featuring on the show, even younger. I think we had like a 2.5-year-old. Yes. I mean, people being taken, people missing for different reasons. Perhaps, you know, we had a young boy in our first and second episode who was autistic. And in the first episode, we got the information out. Second episode, we had a little bit of an update. Mm. And we're going to have that, I believe. It's amazing how many Americans will say, wait, let me go check my Ring doorbell for footage. Oh, yeah, that's up in the cloud. I still have it from last year.
Yeah.
They'll check. They'll say, yeah, I saw something. Oh, I think from that picture being circulated. 1-866-AMW-TIPS. You'll hear me say it throughout Missing Persons. People are making a difference already with their credible sightings.
Yeah, I think it's so wonderful that you're providing actual measurable hope for people who have been missing loved ones, and being able to put that phone number out. And
if we have time to scroll and to play games and to do all the things that we do on ourselves, if we have time for our devices to lead us to entertainment, then I know that they can lead us through to helping someone bring a loved one home. Just putting the story out there means that people have seen this person who's missing. It means that they have a number they can call or a website they can go to, amwtips.com. There are just so many ways that we create and then bring that interactive. And
when we understand our priorities in life, and understanding that if you have the blessing to be a parent or to look after those who require our attention in that capacity, that everything, journalism and politics and everything, should serve that ultimate purpose. Do you feel as though there's a shift at all in attention to the internet, into how kids are exposed? There's a generational gap here of people who are in charge did not grow up in the same set of circumstances that we're raising our children in right now. I'm not 100% sure how we close that gap, but it looks like there's an effort to try to.
Oh, absolutely, there's an effort. And, you know, every generation can say, well, we're different than the one before, but this is the only generation that will have artificial intelligence infused. Like that, there is no other generation like the youngest among us right now who are growing up and those who come after. So with that in mind, how do we protect them? How do we use the technology that can make life easier in some instances, particularly when it comes to disseminating information quickly? I prefer true and honest information, both receiving it and disseminating it myself. So sometimes it can get complicated because it's like turning on a faucet full force and there's just so much coming out. How do you tell? But, you know, we will figure out ways to make it useful for us. The thing that works against us is time, because the longer kids are exposed to too much of that device life and not enough life, I think it damages us in immeasurable ways and for a long period of time. You know, my youngest is just turned 16 on May 1st. My oldest is 18 now, and she's getting ready to start her freshman year in college at the end of the summer. And I look at how dynamically different they are, and they haven't even been on devices their entire lives.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we protected them for a period of time, so they started later than everybody else. But at the same time, I mean, that catch up is quick. They're exposed to, I mean, it's just the world coming through their cell phone. Now, my youngest is not exactly good about keeping her phone charged, and I'm not mad about that.
Yeah, let that go.
Yeah, I'm like, that means you can't get stuck on it.
Yeah.
But I do realize that when I want to hear them, when I want to see them on FaceTime, they're on the other end. So there's a way to make it worth their while to find the good ways to use their cell phones. And I'll say now, you know, to my youngest, I'm going to reach out to you after track practice. I want to hear the first report. I want you to break the news with mom on FaceTime. And we do that sort of thing together. But we also have pretty strict rules around you don't go to bed with your phone.
Yes.
Like, why should I have to say that? but I do, you know, and I think parents then have to take that role of I'm less friend and more parent. And get tougher. And society in general, I like the fact that the current administration is focused on them.
Yes, I do too.
I like their sensibilities on this because what they're saying is, look, parents, we're going to help you out. We're going to make sure that the playing field out there doesn't have your kids being targeted by credit card ads and all the kind. Because everything that comes up in your phone, have you ever noticed you buy a pair of shoes online and then suddenly there's a company in your email that isn't the one you just shopped at, but they're selling shoes?
Yeah. Yeah, we are the product.
What did you say?
I said we are the product. I mean,
gosh, I know.
It's terrifying, especially when you inject children into it. It certainly does.
There's an effort afoot to legalize prostitution in New Orleans, one of America's favorite cities. WWL host Newell Normand, former sheriff of Jefferson Parish, is against it. And here's why.
And what they did is they introduced three amendments to the code of the city of New Orleans to provide immunity from arrest and prosecution relative to certain prostitution-related offenses for persons who report a crime, assist law enforcement in the prosecution of crime, or seek health care services as a result of a crime, to limit the admissibility of evidence to include condoms, other prophylactics, and as evidence of certain criminal activity. And it's kind of very loosely connected. It's loosely written. And typically you see this as the beginning of this move to actually legalize prostitution, is what you've seen in other areas of the country. I don't know that that's either of these council members' thought process, idea, where they want to see this end up or otherwise. But any time that you don't have and you're piecemealing these policy positions as it relates to this, you get in trouble. And many other cities have tried to do this. And I have yet to see a place where it is worked out in the best interest of the community at large ever. In fact, to the contrary, it doesn't. And it does it for a whole lot of reasons, a whole host of reasons. And, you know, in an article that was posted about this, I think they even mentioned some of the cities that they thought that this had actually worked in. And I was kind of curious, so I went and looked at those cities, and that's not exactly what had happened. And I think Chicago was one. And there were some others that were quoted. Baltimore may have been one. But anyway, whether they did or they didn't, it doesn't matter. What happens, though, is when you go look at those cities, this is what you find. What you find are progressive leaders that are saying that if prostitution is decriminalized, sex work will no longer be driven into the shadows, the bowels of society. And prostitutes will more likely report brutal attacks by clients to police, which means and equates to less violence in the streets. Sounds good. You see some of this same language. Whereas the criminalization of sex work often creates an environment where sex workers are vulnerable to exploitation, violence, and fear of legal repercussions that can prevent the reporting of crimes or seeking of medical assistance, a lack of access to legal protection leaves sex workers in a precarious position, unable to report crimes without risking their own safety and or arrest, as well as discouraging individuals from accessing needed medical care, on and on and on and on. This is the problem. The moment that you become less restrictive, the moment that you kind of diminish what the overall flavor of your ordinances and otherwise dealing with sex workers, the more brazen they become and the more difficult it is for law enforcement. And today's world is not like it was back in the 2000s, right? I mean, we have a migrant situation, a migrant nationwide migrant crisis going on right now. We've actually exacerbated sex trafficking in this country because of our border policies, whether we want to admit that or not. And we have put law enforcement behind the proverbial eight ball. And when you see pieces of legislation like this that seek to squelch or diminish the ability of how they deal with sex workers and information that they have available to them for other crimes, and that, in fact, in this city, they say now you shall charge under a city ordinance and not a state statute, which diminishes outcomes, you are now less than. I get that you're looking out for sex workers and the fact that they are in a very risky business. They put themselves out there in a very risky way. You have sex workers of all sorts, you know, cam operators, phone sex operators. You have less client contact in a lot of manners in which they engage in this. And then you have your street-based sex operators, which is what we're talking about here. And in large measure, these individuals are otherwise what? Yeah, you guessed it. Drug addicts. Right? And what you see across this country where you begin to create an environment of lax enforcement, providing these immunities and things of that nature, you see problems. You see neighborhoods lost. Because when there's less enforcement, right, they're likely to take their clients to safer areas to work and operate, like where response time is greater, right? And if I can't arrest that individual because that individual was slapped around by a client and therefore they have all kinds of immunities as a result thereof, meanwhile, their sex operation is still going on, right, in your neighborhood, in your backyard, the degradation that occurs to your community becomes overwhelming. And you've seen this over and over and over again in community after community after community, neighborhoods lost because of this. It happened in Baltimore, Marilyn Mosby, as the DA there. She kind of took a lax approach to all these misdemeanor cases, so to speak. But, you know, you hear this a lot about drug addiction and sex workers are just typically, you know, a one person problem. They don't have that impact on community. Does anybody really believe that any longer? Do you? I don't. Do we really believe that the user is the only problem that we have in our community when we have drug addiction? Do we really believe that sex workers in our community, it's only a one-person problem? They've chose this life for themselves, and if they have a drug addiction on top of it, they're the only ones impacted by it? Do we really believe that as well? No, we don't believe that, right? And we have evidence of it. I remember at one point in time, when I was the chief deputy as well as sheriff, we were having issues on the Veterans Highway hotels. We had neighbors close to those hotels complaining. They were seeing the prostitutes out in the parking lot. We actually passed legislation in Jefferson Parish to allow the hotel operators, mandate hotel operators, to provide information to us when they openly saw what was going on their property. Of course, they're financially benefiting, that they were required to inform us. Why? Because we had shootings there. We had vehicle thefts there. We had auto burglaries there. We had fights there. We had all kinds of issues that were in the parking lots of these establishments just directly adjacent to some really nice neighborhoods and neighborhoods throughout Jefferson Parish. It was a problem. It wasn't a one-person problem. It was a multi-level problem. And then when they started to see their OC rates go down and be replaced by sex workers, then they wanted to cry uncle about, you know, well, there's no enforcement going on here. We got a problem. No, you facilitated this model. You are now suffering the consequences of this model, and you're not able to get the day rates that you want or the OC rates that you want because you decided in the downturn of an economy or otherwise that you were going to help facilitate this economy. You're going to suffer the consequences of these actions. Unless you play nice with law enforcement. Now, this may seem overreaching, may seem pretty aggressive, but not if you lived in, not if your backyard backed up to the parking lot of that hotel, not if you had an auto dealership next door, not if you had a furniture store there, not if you had a restaurant a half a block down, or not if you had a public park literally 300 feet away from that. It became everybody's problem. Everybody's problem. And I just throw this caution out that before we really go down this and we start restricting as to how police can charge and this and that and everything else, it might be better served to maybe give the DA some discretion. And let's see how that works out. But the collection of intelligence information out on the streets, we should not be protecting violators of the law to the extent that they're creating an environment that they're unwilling and know they can take advantage of some of these immunities that are being provided and not communicate with the police. You know, it's the same one-size-fits-all approach that we try all the time that doesn't work very well ever. Sounds great. Looks like that, and as I said before, I'm sure they are sincere in their effort in bringing this forward. I would love to have known how much communication there was with law enforcement on these issues. But you want to lose a quarter real quick? Start relaxing sex worker legislation.
So we've talked about crime in the U.S., and that's scary. But fears about nuclear weapons take it to a whole other level. India and Pakistan, two nuclear-armed nations, saw a decades-old conflict reignite with a terror attack in Kashmir. Find out what's going on right now and decide how frightened we should be about it.
Indian forces reportedly fired missiles across the border into Pakistan and the Pakistani-administered territory of Kashmir early Wednesday morning local time, killing at least eight people. Pakistan vowed to retaliate. The attack marks a rise in tensions between the nuclear-armed neighbors who have a long-standing dispute over the mountainous regions of Kashmir. India and Pakistan have fought three wars over Kashmir since the two nations were divided from the former British India in 1947. India said it struck nine sites in Punjab and Kashmir, targeting infrastructure used by militants linked to last month's deadly attack in the resort town of Pelagam. That's part of India-administered Kashmir. And that killed 26 people. Pakistan reported civilian casualties in at least five locations. India accused Pakistan of supporting separatist violence, while Pakistan denied association with the incident. Since that attack, the terrorist attack, the two sides have scaled back diplomatic ties, closed airspace to each other, exchanged fire across line of control, raising fears of a broader conflict. And then, of course, you have the recently fired missiles. So, we'll stay on top of this. Marco Rubio says we're monitoring the situation between India and Pakistan very closely. He put on X, and he said that hopefully this will end quickly. We'll continue to engage both India and Pakistani leadership toward a peaceful resolution. Rubio's comments came as India's government confirmed early Wednesday it had struck 9 sites in Pakistan and on Pakistan's side of the disputed Kashmir region. That and the New York Times reported much the same. So, yeah, we'll stay on top of that, and hopefully cooler minds will prevail. They'll work this out. We were just had a great meeting with the Prime Minister of India and Trump, and really going to work together and get some great deals done. I mean, you got to remember, India now surpasses China's population, 1.3 billion versus 1.2 billion. And and India and Pakistan, both nuclear powers. And thanks to D.C. for kind of laying it out where, you know, if you have a partnership, it's probably going to be, you know, China and Pakistan hanging out together and us in India. But we hope it doesn't come to that. Hopefully they'll be able to at least, you know, calm these disputes down, maybe work on a lasting scenario down the road.
Because both of those countries, Pakistan, for instance, has 100 deliverable nuclear weapons, at least. India has more, and they have submarines. So this is like the third hot spot in the world for nuclear exchange. The first being North Korea, South Korea, the second being the Middle East, and the third being this. Both have nuclear weapons. China has been trying to cozy up to Pakistan, and they have the most to gain because, you know, India is an enemy of China for the territories that they consider China stole from them over the centuries. And this to me, should be the number one newsmaker, you know, right now, and the biggest worry we have with nuclear weapons so close to each other. And Pakistan's official policy is, if all is lost, launch all the nukes.
There's a new pope in Rome, and he's from Chicago. Did the Vatican pick an American because their liberal position on immigration is costing them members? Tara from The Tara Show at WORD Radio thinks so, and she has some advice for the new pontiff.
Folks, speculating on the choice of the first American pope, not something anybody expected. I got to tell you, there were three names that I was just absolutely praying did not make it through the process. They would have taken the church so far to the left of Francis that I don't even know if the church could have withstood it. These were people who are more interested in Marxist politics than they are in religion of any kind, very much in the Francis mold, but worse. And if you go into the in-depth coverage that was done in a lot of Catholic publications like The Remnant, when Francis was chosen, the conservative cardinals, and there are some, and by conservative, I don't just mean like Republican. I mean like biblically, traditionally conservative Catholic cardinals were not very well organized last time. And we were hearing that they are better organized this time. This guy looks like a compromise candidate between the liberals and the you know, more conservative folks who were voting. And a lot of folks online last night saying, oh, well, this is about Trump. It's a response to Trump. It is, but not in the way they think. And just being inside the church all of these years and growing up in it and knowing like what a looming presence, Pope John Paul was, as much a part of the day-to-day life of the church, always referenced, always referred to. Any news of him was, you know, something people were wanting eagerly to hear. He was beloved. I think that what happened here was that there was genuine rage on the part of Pope Francis when Republicans defied him, voted in the majority for Trump. He thought we were just going to go along. That was the plan. That's why he was backed by the globalists, and I think installed. I still have a ton of questions about whether he was ever actually the Pope, because the real Pope is still alive. People forget that. There was some scandal, particularly in the Italian newspapers, about how he was pushed aside. And I think that a certain globalist political class thought we would just follow the Pope. And I think Francis thought we would just follow the Pope. Well, Catholics are pretty famous for not following the Pope. And so we defied him on Trump, didn't listen, didn't care. And a real schism began between the church in Rome and in America, to the point where Francis was not a factor, is not a factor. I forget we have a Pope. That's how not a factor inside the church he is. There's a picture. No one talks about it. Almost never mentioned. Too divisive. Too much anger. It's like he's not there. And what a contrast between him and John Paul growing up the way that I did. I think the choice of an American Pope for the first time is recognizing that Rome is losing its grip on America, on the church in America. The closest parallel I can think to it is when the Orthodox Church slipped away. You look at the Orthodox Church, it is shockingly similar to the Catholic Church. And during that time, there was no email. It was hard even to get over the roads to, you know, connect those churches. And so they sort of fell apart, fell away, even though the Orthodox Church recognizes the sacraments of the Catholic Church and vice versa. They are almost identical. And yet they are not. The Orthodox just fell off. It fell away. And I'm telling you, that was what was going on in America. It was falling away. In name, sure, still connected. On paper, absolutely still connected, making appointments. But with Rome having absolutely no or very little influence, Lee, of any kind on the church. And if you look at what had been happening inside Rome, Rome is going broke, as it should. Now, we don't need the pomp. We don't need the circumstance. We don't need the glitter. We don't need the gold. It should all be sold. Properties given away, you know, for charity. You know, in other words, sell it, raise the money, give it to charity. Jesus didn't want any of this. And if you look at what happened during Francis and you Google this, Rome is going bankrupt, Lee, and quickly, running a $64 million deficit. In the last year,
having to
sell
property.
Vatican
itself.
Yeah, the Vatican. That's what I mean. I'm sorry. No, yeah. We call it Rome.
Which they're probably bankrupt too.
Yeah, no, they are too. They're going bankrupt. And Francis was a horrible money manager, but there's not a lot you can do when you spend most of your papacy almost targeting your rage on a weekly basis politically at Catholics in America. He never got over it. That we supported Trump at a 54% rate the first time around. We just never got over it. And that really began to show in recent years. I mean, people will go to very far lengths to make sure that money they donate does not go to the Vatican. I do that. I will not give a cent. If I think even a cent of it is going anywhere outside my local church, I will not give the money. I don't want it in Catholic, you know, the Catholic charitable groups that go down to Mexico and break our laws, facilitate lawbreaking. I don't want it in the Vatican. You send it to the Vatican, it's going to end up in Mexico. It's bad. It just is. That's who this Pope was. And many Catholics understood that, did that, and the money dried up. So I think that the selection of an American Pope is to keep the American church from drifting away the way the Orthodox Church once did, but also to get Catholics to open their wallets. Or they're going to have to start selling stuff at the Vatican. I mean, like, they're going to have to start real, because they're broke. And you can see the schism there with the money. The money got cut off. I think that's why they went with an American. That's where the money is. And these cardinals and their, can't use that word, Pope that they chose, Francis, thumbed their nose one time too many. I mean, the Catholic Church is really in crisis. So it's going to be very interesting to see. This seems like a compromise candidate. If they'd gone with one of the bomb throwers, I mean, bankruptcy is inevitable. So this Pope, his first order, he's got to straighten a financial house out. It's not going to be easy. Don't mean to go on and on, Lee, but that's kind of what I see and what I hear and what people are saying in my family and Catholics I know. So.
Yeah. Obviously a huge story for
most
huge. Of the world.
Huge. One thing he could start doing, Pope Leo, stay out of American politics. Stay out of it. Just stay out of it. Now, with that brought up, some interesting things about Leo. He's a very got a very, very, very long record as a registered Republican in Chicago. And voted when he was here. He's obviously spent a lot of time in Peru. But when he has been home, he has religiously, no pun intended, voted in the Republican primary. He's got an actual on-the-ground activist record of showing up at pro-life events and marching in Chicago.
Well, that is the stance of the Catholic Church, if I'm not mistaken, is pro-life.
It is, absolutely. But he's unavowedly pro-life.
Yeah.
He's also pro-straight heterosexual marriage. He is not, and he is very emphatically on the record against any kind of gay marriage. None of this accommodating stuff that Francis would do, where he wouldn't bless it. He would make these statements, you know, welcoming people, having couples, even though he couldn't, you know, doctrine-wise undo the teachings of the church. The Pope can't do that. A lot of people don't know that, but they can. He would signal stuff. And this Pope, I don't know, is going to be doing that. So it's going to be very interesting to see what's going on here. But I think the biggest motivating factor is with many things in the world, money.
You think?
They need money. They need money, and we have the most money here in America. Catholics have deep pockets, and those wallets are shut. So we'll see. We'll see if he can get the wallets back open. And it may not be that bad his first years. There's some excitement. Nobody knows what he's going to do. It's kind of like the honeymoon of a presidency. But he really needs to lay off the criticisms of J.D. Vance and Donald Trump. He did that on border stuff. The weird thing with the Catholic Church and illegal immigrants in America is that to the extent that they have a religion, they're all Catholic. I mean, you look at my church, it's like two churches. We went to the Spanish Mass last week. Because we were traveling, and that's when we got home. The only person who really fully understands my daughter, she's fluent in Spanish. But, there aren't many people who are there legally. I'm just going to be nice about it. And you know that because they don't speak English. They're newly arrived. And I'm sure some are on visas, but most are not. And so when you consider that a lot of the actual people doing the migrating are Catholics, that's the weird part for the Catholic Church is to come out against it. Well, okay, but they are the ones moving. They've got to resolve that and stay the heck out of the politics. So I hope this Pope's going to be better. I really do. Because you know what, Lee, we really need all religions and all branches of the tree of Christianity. We need strong, moral leaders who will push back on the culture. By the way, he's got a long history of retweeting stuff, pushing back on the woke LGBT plus culture. So we will see. It will be interesting.
Thanks for listening to this week's Red Meat Podcast, the tastiest tidbits from Odyssey's local news talk radio stations across the country. Smash that subscribe button wherever you get your podcasts. And tune into these shows during the week on the Odyssey app, your smart speaker, desktop, phone, radio, or wherever you listen. There's no excuse to go hungry.